Iowa isn't known for grand vistas, but it is beautiful, even if sometimes you need to look closely to see it. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today I'll talk with three people who have studied Iowa's landscape very closely and share its beauty with others. Linda and Robert Scarth have traveled the world photographing nature, but some of their most impressive work can be found in the collection Deep Nature, Photographs from Iowa. I'll talk with them about their craft and their collaboration. And later this hour, Bill Witt will be here. He turned his lens toward Iowa's native landscape. The photographs featured in his collection, Enchanted by Prairie, will take you back hundreds of years. You're welcome to join our conversation today. Tell us about your favorite places to photograph in Iowa. Give us a call after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're going to talk about capturing Iowa's beauty in photographs. And later this hour, I'll talk with Bill Witt, the photographer behind the collection Enchanted by Prairie. With me right now are Robert and Linda Scarth. They're photographers who have traveled the world photographing nature and other things as well. But much of their work has been done right here in Iowa and is featured in the collection Deep Nature, Photographs from Iowa. And I just learned that I actually got this show backwards because Bill Witt's book takes a look at the broad landscape in Iowa. Your book was actually a follow-up to that book to look very closely at Iowa. Linda, what was the goal with this collection?
Well, when Holly Carver approached us, she said that she was hoping that we could show and demonstrate some of the lovely little things in Iowa, because people are generally looking more broadly at the landscape. And if one looks closely, there's a lot there.
There is so much to see, and we'll talk about some of the pictures in your book and some of the ways that you got those pictures in a moment. But first, I want to talk about you, because both of you come from academic backgrounds. Linda, you have degrees in child development, education, library science. Robert, you have degrees in animal breeding, genetics, and statistics, and you both come from this academic universe. When did you first start taking pictures? And Robert, you can go first.
Well, some of the earliest pictures was when I was working at the university. I needed the pictures in the teaching, livestock judging and a variety of other things. And when we went to field days and livestock events, we'd take pictures of the people there. And then whenever we had a vacation time, we normally, when we went to, either one of us went to a meeting, then we would plan extra time along there where we could stop at state or national parks to do photography.
And how about you, Linda? Did you start at the same time as Robert?
I had aspirations as a girl. My father had a twin lens reflex that I lusted over, but we really started photographing together. It was an art form that we both could do, we both enjoyed, and we enjoy being and working together.
What made you realize that you really had an eye for photography that not everybody has?
Sometimes we've thought about it and realized that we both were, when we were university students, livestock judging team members. And when I was at the University of Wisconsin, that year that I was on the university livestock judging team, there were only 7 girls in the country. But
on livestock judging teams.
Yes.
Yeah, on livestock.
I think we understood that.
And Bob also, we both judged livestock all of in other countries as well as here. But that teaches one to look closely and see the parts and how they work together. And we think that has something to do with us looking at things closely.
How does your photography work as a collaboration? Because I think when we think about somebody going out and taking pictures, you think about this solo photographer going out and taking pictures. How do you work together, Robert?
Well, one of the things we use is a little talkabouts. And when we go to a state or national park, we start, and where it says this walk will be normally 2 or 3 hours, well, we can only get like a quarter of the way in 2 or 3 hours, or it may take us 5 hours if we really get involved in going a good bit of the walk. and looking at the details.
And we often photograph the same subjects, and when we were still with film, we had to label our boxes because sometimes we couldn't tell who had done what. And we right now we have four cameras, and two are Bob's, two are mine, but we can use any one of them. But we try to remember. Bob says he has an internal GPS that can take him back to any photograph he's ever made. But
well, not any. There's some of the more memorable ones.
Okay.
Within maybe 10 feet sometimes.
And when we're selecting for, say, this our book or for a gallery show or some other purpose, we don't really think about who took what. We collect the ones that we like and then pick the one that appeals at that time. And we always end up about half and half, so it's never a problem.
Well, and it just always works out that way?
Yeah. Yes.
When you set out to take pictures, do you plan in advance the kind of pictures that you want to take on this journey?
Normally, Linda will research the area in terms of the type of flowers there, and we also try to time it when certain flowers, especially rare ones, will be at their peak or likely be in the peak bloom stage.
We do a lot of keeping and collecting of information, and there are so many people here across the state who help us, whether they know us or not, because we participate and lurk on the Iowa Native Plant Discussion List, the Prairie States Mushroom Club group, and the Bird List, the Iowa Ornithological Union's list, so we know what's happening where.
You're always lurking out there.
Also, there's funny. A new active insect list, too.
Oh, yes. Yes, the Iowa Insect List is also a clue as to what's happening. And in the surrounding states as well. Right now, we're hoping to do some photography of a couple of the subspecies of sage grouse next spring. So we're lurking on the Colorado Birding List, so we'll be knowing where things are come spring.
I'm talking with Linda and Robert Scarth, who are photographers behind the collection Deep Nature, Photographs from Iowa, among other collections. And I know talking about pictures on the radio leaves you wanting more. You can go to our Facebook page if you like Iowa Public Radio, and we have a link to Linda and Robert's website that has many, many of their photographs that you can look at. It's scarthphoto.com, S-C-A-R-T-H, photo.com. And again, you can find that link on our Facebook page as well. When you go out to take pictures, obviously you need to be looking for small details. What do you look for in an environment? How do you start?
We don't take pictures. We make pictures. I think most photographers make pictures if they're really thinking about it. And it's having your eye out for color and composition. Back when we were black and white photographers in the dark ages, then composition was the main thing. But then as we switched to color with color transparency and now digital, moving slowly, looking up, down, sideways, and backwards, really just to see what catches the eye. We'll have subjects in mind that this is an area that should be good for whatever. And then it's a matter of capturing it. And we also notify one another. Bob mentioned that we use talkabouts, and we sort of sometimes leapfrog, and one will be working in an area, and then the other one will go on, having finished there, and then spot something else and report back. Also, I took a left at this fork in the road, too.
Well, you need to be able to find each other.
No. Yeah. A few years ago in New Mexico, Bob swears that we would have never found each other if we hadn't had the talkabouts.
When we look at your website and look at all of the many pictures that you've taken all over the world, you have lived in Australia and taken pictures there, and you've taken pictures in Africa and Alaska and all over the United States. Robert, what brought you to Iowa?
Well, primarily because Linda wanted to get a master's in library science, and our daughter and son-in-law were living here in Iowa City. So that was a major thing that drew us here.
When you got here, Iowa is not known for having, in fact, people who don't live here and haven't visited here, if you tell them that Iowa is beautiful, they'll sort of laugh at you. So when you knew you were coming to Iowa, did you think that you'd have photography opportunities here?
Yes, not as much in terms of the wide landscapes like Bill Witt does. And we have the advantage of doing small things is we can kind of create our own environment. We use white photographic umbrellas to shade and soften the light, because one of the mistakes that most people make, let's say they go out in their garden to take a beautiful, what they think is going to be a beautiful picture of a flower, it comes back, it doesn't look like what it looked like to them when they were taking it, because there's too much light. If you have diffuse soft light, then you'll get more saturation in your colors, and you'll be able to see into. Like if you're photographing the forest, if it's a real sunny day, all you see is the edge. If it's a really overcast day, you can see into the forest.
So I guess a lot of us probably think about wanting to take photographs on beautiful sunny days. Do you look for lower light days?
A high overcast is our favorite kind of day, or if it's not early in morning or late afternoon. And that's one of the reasons we carry diffusers, usually our white umbrellas, because we can control the light on small subjects and we can reflect light in. We use reflectors. As I said, we make photographs, as all photographers really do.
When you first started making photographs, it was in the age of film. And, of course, part of taking photographs on film is also developing the photographs. And that's an artwork in and of itself. How has your work changed now that you've moved into the digital age?
Well, our digital darkroom is one of my favorite places. A lot of photographers don't like the post-processing. I enjoy it thoroughly. I did all of the post-processing for the book so that the printers really had very little to do, because I enjoy that. We had a black and white darkroom when we were young, and you play in chemicals for too long, and then we moved on. I did a little bit of color, Cibachrome work, but not much. And since we used slide film, transparency film, the switch from transparency to digital was almost seamless. And we went over to the dark side in 2004.
So actually, in some ways, early adopters of that technology.
Pretty early.
I'm talking to Robert and Linda Scarth, who are photographers, and you can see a lot of their work in the collection Deep Nature, Photographs from Iowa. We also have a link to their website from our Facebook page. It's scarthphoto.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we're talking about pictures today. We're talking intensely right now about pictures of Iowa. And I'm talking with photographers Robert and Linda Scarth right now, who have captured a great deal of Iowa's beauty through their lens. In a little while, in about 15 minutes, I'll be joined by Bill Witt, who is also a photographer, and he's captured many of Iowa's landscapes. He's taken a look way back in time to our native landscape, and his collection is called Enchanted by Prairie. We'll be talking with him in about 15 minutes. And I want to talk about your photographs now. And one of the things that is featured prominently in your book, and again, these are up close photographs. The collection is called Deep Nature, and we do go deep. We get very close in and get to see the dewdrops on the flowers and all of the details. And one of the things that is prominently featured are pictures of insects. Why do you like to take pictures of insects so much?
They're the jewelry that flowers wear. And, of course, people love insect jewelry as well. It goes in and out of fashion, but is among the most beautiful. Insects are the most numerous of the little animals on the planet, but they're also seldom seen except for mosquitoes, but even those can be pretty.
When
the Small spiders are a particular fascination for me. There's a picture of a zebra spider in here, and the jumping spiders have the best vision of spiders, and or among the best. And this little fellow was watching my lens very, very closely. He has big eyes, but he was seeing this bigger eye coming at him. And it's kind of fun to do, and it's sometimes stealthy. And the importance of composition in insects, otherwise you just have a biological specimen, and you need to work to get an interesting composition around it and show its habitat as well.
How do you do that?
Well, most all our insect photos are taken outside, but occasionally we have a insect, like a couple years ago we had a zebra spider jump on me when I was going in the house, so I figured, well, he's inviting himself in, and we kept it and fed it for a couple of months. But here again, you need to, like for dragonflies, they're quite interesting to do.
And they're fast.
Yes, but some of them have a kind of area that they defend and some favorite perches in that area. And if you stay, normally I get down on my knees, one of the most useful things for my photography insects is these foam garden knees, because I spend a lot of time on my knees photographing, because if you're at the same level of a dragonfly or a little lower, they don't see you as a threat. When you stand up above, and especially when you cast a shadow on them, well, normally they're gone. And I've had dragonflies come and sit on me, and in fact, take one on a perch, get it set on my finger, and move it over to another perch. Wow. In their territory.
How long do you sometimes spend taking a picture of an insect or waiting for an insect to come to a flower?
Well, in that case, I sometimes maybe half an hour. And the dewdrops we're looking through the dewdrops. They're like miniature fisheye lenses.
Yeah,
that's another thing that
there are just
I enjoy
beautiful
doing.
Pictures in here.
And those normally take even longer to set up, because you can't have any wind, and you can't bump the plant because the dewdrops will be gone. And I like the thing that they're just how they magnify everything behind them.
You know, let me describe this, because there are a couple of different pictures in your book with using these dewdrops as refractors. And so it just shows a leaf or a stem with dewdrops on it, and you can see flowers refracted through the lens of the dewdrop. And it's really, they're both remarkable pictures. I think they're just stunning. And it almost looks like a tiny world.
It is a tiny world. The ones in the book are Bob's. He has more patience than I do at setting up, because it can take him quite a while to set up. But sometimes even architectural features, if you find a plant in front of a brick wall or a stone wall and photograph through the drop, you'll have the drop filled with little stones or bricks. So that's kind of fun to do. Last summer? Yes. One of the longest times we took photographing an insect was 2.5 hours, and that was watching a cicada emerge and doing the stages of its immersion as it emerged from its
as it shed its skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah.
One of my favorite pictures in the book is of a little bee chasing a small butterfly out of a prickly pear bloom. And it's just this amazing moment. And I looked at that and I thought, how on earth did they capture that on film?
That one happens to be film. That's one of the older ones in the book. I was following the butterfly around and trying to sneak up on it, and it lighted in the prickly pear, and I thought, oh, good. And then the bee evicted, and I guess fast reaction time is needed, too, to be a photographer in that case.
And right, because you just captured that tiny moment.
And there's some in there, like the ladybug on dandelions. Well, the native ladybugs have been kind of pushed out by the Asian ones, so it's now difficult to find native ladybugs.
I shared this book with my children, and the ladybug picture was one of my son's favorites. He got very, very excited. He's 3 years old and did a lot of shouting about that picture. We've talked a lot about the plants and the insects, but you take a lot of pictures of animals as well. And in this book, some pictures of birds.
Yes.
But looking at your website, obviously you've taken pictures of much larger animals all over the world as well. How do you have to approach that kind of photography differently than plants?
Well, you have to make certain that you're in a safe place if you're doing a grizzly bear. But it's partitioning the world and just focusing on the subject matter. It doesn't change that much for me. Does it for you, Bob?
No. And when we were up in Alaska, there were several places we went into that were a little gravel with little low fence around it, and that's where the people would stay. And the bears just became used to the people and looked upon them as another tree standing there. And as long as you didn't make a bunch of noise and do anything foolish, the bears just pretty well ignored you and did what they would normally do.
With digital cameras, I mean, some of them make noise, like the old film cameras. Some of them don't. Do you have concerns about how much noise your camera is making when you're photographing an animal?
No, because animals always know you're there anyway. We dress it quietly and try to blend in, but we don't go to a great deal of trouble of hiding, except sometimes for birds. Because animals know you're there. That's why they have survived. And as long as you're quiet and non-threatening and stay in a place that isn't too threatening to them, usually it's fine.
I'm talking with photographers Robert and Linda Scarth, and we're talking primarily about their collection, Deep Nature, Photographs from Iowa, but the other photographs they've taken as well. And you're welcome to join our conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'd love to hear your questions, of course, but also your favorite places to take pictures in Iowa. Let us know, 866-780-9100. And Robert, I'm sorry I cut you off.
Well, you were talking about the noise the camera makes. In fact, in Uruguay, the Andean Cocoa Rock, I was up in Alec photographing.
Ecuador.
And when the camera clicked, the bird did the same kind of a click because they use a similar kind of a click to communicate. So in that case, every time I clicked the camera, the bird came closer.
Oh, wow. You were communicating with it.
Yeah, and it would sit on a branch, and then it would look at me, and then it would jump up and 180 degrees and face the other way and still look at me.
Oh, that's really neat.
One of the things we haven't mentioned in our book is the essay by John Pearson, Small Places, Unbounded Spaces. We were very fortunate that John agreed to do an essay for the book that accompanies our photographs. We did a small essay on why we photograph, and he did a larger essay on the beautiful and wonderful places within Iowa and how he came to admire and love them and how they are part of his professional life, but also his personal life. And we'd recommend his essay to anyone who wants to read about the wonders of Iowa.
Anybody who loves it or is coming to love it.
Yes.
I want to go back to talking about animals for just a moment. When you're photographing an animal, what are you hoping to get? We talked about with insects, you don't want to just have a picture of a specimen. So what kind of connection are you trying to make with that animal?
Well, cameras face both ways. So essentially, it's how you communicate with your subject and how it's communicating back and the relationship of that. And we're intruding on their worlds, of course, and we want them to be expressed in their essence, but remembering what we're bringing to it, and it's what we see that we photograph. People sometimes don't think about how a camera not only expresses what has been made or the photograph that's been made, but also the emotional and intellectual response of the photographer. And sometimes people who are photographing don't remember what they are projecting into their photographs.
And for flowers, one of the things we try to do is to isolate and simplify. If you get too many flowers sometimes in a photograph, then it distracts from maybe what you want to be your main flower or flowers for people to see. And we're talking about time, too. Several years ago at Pleasant Creek, we had had a prairie warbler that was one of the first ones ever been seen in the state. And I spent, I guess, probably 25 hours over about 3 days waiting for this bird to come and where I could photograph it and it to get used to me.
And you
and it's in the book.
It is in the book.
Page 27.
And so you went back to the same place every day to just to try to accustom the bird to your
Yeah, he had a favorite tree, favorite perch tree.
And you went there every day for how long, you said?
3 days.
3 days. Oh, that's a wonderful story. Well, let's talk about your favorite places to go in Iowa to take pictures, because obviously with these very tiny subjects, you can find beauty anywhere, but you must have favorite locations to go.
Well, close to home, besides our backyard where we do a lot of photography, Wickiup Hill Outdoor Learning Center, the Linn County Conservation Facility is a favorite because there are many kinds of microenvironments there and a lot of species come there. When I need to be, there's one place in Iowa where you can be without any sound, and that's in the bottom of Wildcat Den State Park, down in the gully there, because everywhere else you go, you will hear a road or the human element somewhere, but it's possible to sometimes be down in that gully.
Well, it's interesting that you mention Wildcat Den State Park because it's a beautiful place, but it is a place where there have been people visiting for so long that they have made their marks.
Oh, yes.
Everywhere. And, you know, if you look at the rock, there are so many carvings mm-hmm. in the rock. Is it sometimes difficult to try to isolate a completely natural area for your pictures?
Humans have been here for so long, including the Native Americans that were here before, that we all leave our marks. But it is possible. Sometimes you can't take something that you would like because the human element is just too obvious. And we try to keep the human element at a minimum in our photographs. There are many nature photographers who incorporate the human element all the time. But we do sometimes, but we're looking for the little jewels.
Are there any places that Linda hasn't mentioned that you want to mention, Robert?
One where you have to worry about people carving in a rock is Gitche Manitou, way up in the northwest corner of the state. It's the oldest known rock in Iowa. And I think it's they estimate it to be 1.6 million years old. And it's a pink quartzite that's very hard, so you'd have a hard time. And we have an image in here of a lichen growing on that.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And you don't have to worry about people writing their names on that.
However, people have that has been quarried, mm-hmm. and there are lots of other human elements there. But the Les Hills are beautiful. We have images from all over the state in here. That wasn't done purposefully. It just so happened that those were good representations that went together. And people welcome us to their special places, and we're always pleased. It's wherever we've been most recently that's our favorite place.
You most recently, mm-hmm. you did a long photography trip in Alaska. Where are you going next?
Possibly, well, I mentioned that we're thinking about sage grouse in the early spring, and we're thinking in early summer, Newfoundland. Bob wants to photograph puffins.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide?
Well, it's a lot easier now with the web where you can do research of what's available at the various places and maybe the best times to find them. Another place we would like to go again sometime is Australia, where we live for 7 years, and there's a lot of beauty down there to photograph, too.
On your website, we mentioned this earlier, you have many of your pictures. In fact, if you go to your website, you can find a link mm-hmm. to this book, Deep Nature, and all of the pictures in the book are there. Why do you share all of your pictures in that way?
We're both teachers. And if people see things, particularly from the Midwest, which isn't well represented in books for the most part, I mean, Bill's book and our book are among, and there are a couple of photographers in Nebraska and Minnesota also that we, whose work we admire. But we do it because perhaps somebody will see something that they think is worth taking care of.
Yeah.
There's a conservation ethic underneath this. We're great admirers of Aldo Leopold's writings, and some of them guide us.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for inviting.
Robert and Linda Scarth are photographers who have taken pictures all over the world, and you can see their photographs in the collection Deep Nature, Photographs from Iowa. You can also find them on their website, which is scarthphoto.com, and they have all of their pictures on their website. You can also go to our Facebook page and find a link to that website. Our Facebook page is Iowa Public Radio. In a moment, Bill Witt will be here. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about photography in Iowa. Robert and Linda Scarth were here earlier, and now with me is Bill Witt. He's the photographer behind the collection Enchanted by Prairie. He's also a former state representative and the intellectual property officer for the University of Northern Iowa and an old dear friend of mine. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Bill, I want to talk first about your relationship with prairie, because I know that growing up in the state of Iowa back in the 80s and 70s, prairie wasn't something that you saw very much of. When did you first become acquainted with the landscape?
Well, I grew up in far northeastern Iowa, and so there were prairies there, although I didn't realize it. Those would have been the hill prairies or goat prairies that you see on the steep south-facing slopes along the Mississippi and some of the tributary rivers. But I didn't really realize what they were. And then probably would have been in the mid-70s or so that I got my first acquaintance with prairie through Daryl Smith here at the University of Northern Iowa, who told me about this lovely place that they were working to try and preserve, and that was then called the Mark Sand Prairie, now known as the Cedar Hills Sand Prairie. And so I began going out there and looking around and getting guidance from Daryl and from Paul Whitson, who was the professor of ecology here at UNI in those days, Larry Eilers, and some other very fine people who really love the land and love to see it in its wholeness and its integrity. And so I gradually fell in love with that prairie and then expanded my experience and my vision to others.
What do you think started that process for you when you found yourself trying to look closely at prairie and understand the landscape? What made you fall in love?
Well, I've always been kind of a contemplative person at heart, and to go out alone on a prairie places you, I think, in a special relationship with earth and sky and the elements and the weather. And Arnold Webster, who was a fine arborist and naturalist and prairie enthusiast, put it very well once when he said, "An hour alone on the prairie will wash the meanness out of your soul." And I found that being out on a prairie and allowing the prairie to sort of absorb you, if you will. We think about absorbing ourselves, but prairie is a landscape that can absorb you. And so I found a great sense of peace and wonder. Sometimes restoration, you know, when you're frustrated. I always said that going out to a prairie was a sanity outlet. And following Arnold Webster's prescription, spend an hour out there alone and let it wash the meanness and the weariness out of you.
Bill, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've done many things in your career. When did you first start taking pictures?
Probably when I was about 10. I remember I found an old pre-World War II folding roll film camera in the attic, and I taught myself to use it, and I've been at it ever since.
But it wasn't something that you considered making your career early on?
No. I always thought I'd probably become a professor or something. But I've always had a passion for light and for just the beauty of light itself. That's some of my earliest memories, in fact, of being a small child and just watching light fall across a hardwood oak floor. I think I was about 2 years old, and I was just enraptured with the beauty of that light on an early winter morning, and I can still remember that experience. And light continues to be the animating force in a lot of the pictures. If you look at the book, you'll see that the light is very often, in my photos of Prairie, a very active presence. It's creating patterns and shadows, and there's contrast often, backlight and so forth. So anyway, I've always had this fascination with light, and been engaged in seeing how the light falls and what it creates as it does.
When I was talking to Robert and Linda a few minutes ago, one of the things that Linda said was that there's one place that she knows of in Iowa where you can go and experience absolute silence. And one of the things that I love most about your book is that you have managed to take pictures of Prairie in Iowa that don't have the other elements of the human landscape in them. And I've spent a lot of my life seeking out prairies and spending time in prairies. And when I do, every time I do, I try to imagine what it would be like if I couldn't hear the road and if I couldn't see the power lines. But that's really a challenge. How on earth did you find enough places to take pictures where you couldn't see the power lines or the road in the distance?
It takes time. And as I said, sometimes you have to let the prairie absorb you. The Cedar Hill Sand Prairie, for example, where I took many of the pictures in the book, it's surrounded. It has a big high line on one end, and now a farmer has, rented out ground, and there's a big cell phone tower that seems to get in the way, and there's a road that runs on the west side of it. But you can still get into it, and you can still, open yourself to the enchantment that the prairie offers. And I say in my essay at the end of the book that, enchantment in this case is about the magic that's in reality. And when you have even a small piece of prairie, 40 or 60 or 90 or 10 or 2 acres, you can still be enchanted by it because in its wholeness, in its integrity, you can be drawn in and then just let yourself go with that. There's the divine spark that drives the cosmos is still very much present and there for the discovery.
I'm talking with Bill Witt, who's the photographer behind the collection Enchanted by Prairie. And we've also put up a link to a site about the book on our Facebook page. If you go to Facebook and look for Iowa Public Radio, you can find it. And there you can see the cover of the book and a few of the pictures in the book. How long did you spend taking these pictures, Bill?
I think the first picture in the book was taken about 30 years ago. And the last ones were taken about 4 weeks before we had to go to the designer and the press. So they spanned a period from about 1980 until 2008, I guess.
So really a lifetime taking these pictures.
Yeah.
When did you first conceive of putting them together in a collection?
I honestly didn't. And I have to thank Holly Carver at the University of Iowa Press for really pushing me along with that. We had been working on producing our Guide to the Native Orchids of Iowa, and at one point she was saying, I'd like to see some of the habitat kinds of photos, the landscape photos, And so I showed her a bunch, and I showed her a few more, and she said, "We've got to do a book of your prairie photos. That's it. We've got to do it." And I said, "Okay." So I have to thank Holly and her vision and her stick-to-itiveness on my behalf, I guess.
So since you didn't set out to make this collection, these are pictures you've taken over a lifetime, this question may not really apply, but when you go out to a prairie to take pictures, how do you approach it?
I try and approach it with a sense of openness and of just going out to experience it for what it is, to be there, to be present to it, and see what it has to say to me. You know, oftentimes I may spend a whole afternoon in a place, not just a prairie, but some of the beautiful areas in Northeast Iowa and elsewhere. I may spend a whole afternoon and realize that in the course of 3 or 4 hours I've traveled a grand space of 100 yards. There's just so much there if we're willing to be open and to look and to listen and to hear what a place has to say to us.
You do have some photographs of animals in your book, although most of the pictures are of plants or of the landscape. How do you approach taking pictures of animals?
I am not a wildlife photographer per se. People who specialize in that are true experts. And I sometimes get lucky. And the case of the sandhill crane, I think, is probably the classic. I'd wanted to go over to Ham Marsh. I'd been there several times on behalf of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, photographing the owner, donors, and photographing the marsh and so forth. And I'd heard that there were some sandhill cranes there. So I went over one morning in late May. And, it was one of those extraordinary experiences where, you know, nature just gives you, just hands you this silver platter. In this case, it was, I don't know if this crane had love on his mind or what. He was in his breeding plumage, which means that the normally gray bird has slathered himself with iron oxide-rich mud, and so he assumes this orangey-brown color. And I came over the brow of a little hill heading toward the marsh, and the grass was all short. I mean, I was completely exposed to anybody that wanted to see me. And, you know, the only thing I can think of is that here I was in kind of my brown khaki-colored pants and vest, and I was carrying this camera with a long beak-like lens on it. And as I approached the marsh, this crane just came out and started displaying for me and parading back and forth and calling to me. So I just dropped down on all fours and set my camera on a tripod. And for 45 minutes, this bird just went back and forth, circling me, you know, talking to me. And I thought, are you in love with me or what?
Well, I love the picture that you chose because you can almost hear him talking. He's got his mouth open, and it's almost a visceral experience. When you take pictures for 45 minutes, how do you pick the one that you're going to put in the book?
You just do. In this case, I think you nailed it. I mean, this is where he was very animated. It was a combination of, yes, he was in focus, B, he was pretty close, C, he was doing his thing, and you can tell that he's got something to say. I had another picture that I liked where he was just kind of strutting with his head back and his long neck and kind of an S curve, and he was looking very magisterial and macho. But I liked the one where he was just kind of letting it all hang out and saying, "Come on, what are you doing? What are you waiting around for?"
Well, you describe your animal shots as maybe being lucky shots. There's another amazing picture that really must be a lucky shot, and that's with your northern harriers. You have an adult female and her young in the same picture in flight.
Yes. That was another one of those instances where that was at Hayden Prairie, and it was in early July. And I'd simply been out on the prairie for quite some time. And I found that when I entered this certain area of the prairie, these two harriers began flying out in front of me and around me. And I don't know if I was maybe stirring up little voles or something, but occasionally they would stoop. They would dive down into the grass and come back up. And so I just stood there, and this went on for, about 45 minutes. And I burned through a lot of film until that one image just came into place with the younger bird just a few feet overhead, and then the mother, I assume it's the mother, you know, higher up with the late afternoon light shining on both of them, and then the moon, the half moon riding up in the sky. So, that was another gift of the cosmos, as somebody says.
When people look through this book and look at your prairie photographs, what do you want them to take away from it?
I think more than anything, just a sense of beauty. We are constantly assaulted in our society by commercializing of beauty and meaning, and in the course of it, we really trivialize it. But there are real sources of beauty in our world and in our lives if we're willing to remain open to them. And I think that we need that. The philosopher-writer John O'Donohue, who died recently and who was featured on an interview with Krista Tippett recently, talks about this, that deep inside us we have a need, we have a hunger for what is truly beautiful and meaningful in our lives. And to be able to go out into a place like a prairie, which is just fecund with beauty and still retains. It wouldn't have this beauty if it didn't also have, real qualities of its integrity, its ancient natural integrity, still alive and coursing through it. That we can become resensitized and re-enlivened by this sense of beauty. And so I would hope that people would look at this book and come away with a sense of reverence and delight and gratitude that we can still find such beauty in our environment.
Bill, thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Charity.
Bill Witt is the photographer behind the collection Enchanted by Prairie. The book also features an essay by Osha Gray Davidson. Bill also is a former state representative in Iowa and the intellectual property officer for the University of Northern Iowa. And again, if you go to our Facebook page, you can find a link to see pictures by Bill Witt and pictures by Robert and Linda Scarth as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Phil Moss in Cedar Falls. You can always listen to the show if you missed it. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org, and you can get in touch with us at any time. We'd love to hear your comments, your questions, and suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm off tomorrow, but Dennis Reese will be with you tomorrow for Hort Day, along with Richard Duran and Donald Lewis. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.